They have downloaded many, many, many shows over the years. We've been on for about 10 years. They've downloaded many shows. And I think I got an email or a Facebook message from them recently that they are continuing to download Socialist Alternative Radio shows. So you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on WMFO 91.5 FM. And check Socialist Alternative Radio's Facebook page out. We post some really interesting pieces. Some stuff from Socialist Alternative, but also stuff from other areas, other sources. And we do have listeners, as I said, from all over the world. It's really gratifying. Obviously, they're listening through the internet. And we get messages from there every once in a while. Every once in a while, we have a little debate on Facebook, that sort of thing. I mean, it's interesting. If you checked out our Facebook page over the last few weeks, you'd get the best of both worlds, so to speak, or the worst of both worlds. You get a little bit of a debate with the lesser evilists, but you also get a little bit of a debate with ultra-leftists that say nothing to be gained from elections, and Jill Stein is just like all the rest of them, you know? And it's not true, actually. Jill Stein is putting forward a really good program. She's running for president as a member of the Green Party. And it's not so much Jill Stein winning the election, which some people will write back to me on Facebook extremely ignorantly, they'll say, but she's not going to win. And I will say, that was never the point. The point of running a third-party candidate in this country, especially a progressive candidate, is to build forces for future elections. You have to lose elections to win future elections. That's the way it goes in almost all cases. There are very few exceptions where someone wins an election first for the first time they try, a party or an individual. So we've talked on the show a lot about Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, last name Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T. Shama is a current sitting Seattle City Councilor, Seattle, Washington, USA City Councilor. She's been reelected twice, her first election and second reelection. She ran as an open member of Socialist Alternative and as an open socialist. So this is an extremely important election to pay attention to, and it's actually mentioned in this article I'm going to get into in a few minutes. And but did Shama win the first election she ran in? No. A lot of people don't know that because she seemed to come out of nowhere. The first election, Shama did quite well, which is why, you know, we encouraged her and she accepted to run in a second election because she did so well in the first one. She ran for, I believe it was a state legislature position. I could have some of the details wrong. I apologize. She ran for state legislature position prior to her election in 2012, 2013. And she got 35% of the vote. Totally, you know, which was amazing to run against like a powerful Democrat in Washington state and get 25% of the vote as an open socialist. That woke a lot of people up, even within Socialist Alternative, to the potential of running another candidate in that area, this time for city council, but it was for at-large city council for the entire city. That makes it tougher in some ways, easier in other ways, but tougher in some ways. And we ran at-large. Shama agreed to run. She ran as an open socialist, openly as a member of Socialist Alternative, and with a program focusing on many important issues, but at the time, you know, 2012, around 2012, the need for a $15 minimum wage, once elected, turning the support into a mass campaign led by Socialist Alternative, led by Shama Sawant, into a $15 minimum wage movement, which got support of unions and others, and eventually Seattle became the first city in the nation with a $15 minimum wage law, which has helped tens of thousands of workers. And the law isn't exactly what we wanted. There are some provisos to it in terms of delayed implementation that are egregious, that are not good, and a couple other details that are really not good in terms of, I believe, workers in their teens and so on. I have to double check that. But I think that a clause stuck through at the end that gave them a sub-minimum wage. I have to double check that. It was mostly the implementation over time that was not necessary. It should have happened all at once. But in any case, it's now happening, and tens of thousands of workers have gotten, you know, very big pay increases, gone from low wages up to 15 an hour, and in other cases that will continue to, for some, up to 18 an hour by the time the law expires. And so that was a great victory, and there's been a lot of other more minor, if you want to call them that, victories that have not got the publicity that's gotten. The $15 minimum wage fight got, of course, that spread to other cities once Seattle got that. And that actually started in SeaTac, but it got held up, and it was not led by us. It was led by the labor movement in SeaTac, and they got held up on a technicality, just like a movement that we just led in Minneapolis, meaning Socialist Alternative, for $15 minimum wage that got held up by the courts at the last minute. It should have been on the ballot this fall, and it wasn't. And there's going to be a rally tomorrow in Minneapolis, if you know anyone there, in support of $15 minimum wage. Go to socialistalternative.org again for more information on that. We already talked about the youth tour of a British socialist and reasons for that, and we're getting into the elections more. But I'm going to take a quick break, play some music, then come back to the elections, because that's a lot all at once. And you're listening to Social Alternative Radio. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. That was Green Day with Holiday. And if you're a regular listener of the show, you know we play that song a lot. And you might say, why do they play when I have a co-host? the same songs over and over again. Well, number one, we don't. If you're careful to check, we don't do that. But we do play some of the same songs a lot. Guilty as charged. You know, as I get older, I'm just not as eclectic as I used to be in my tastes. I kind of want to focus on certain things and get to know them well rather than be all over the place. You know, jack of all trades, master of none type thing, if you ever heard that old expression. Hey, before we get more into the elections, just want to mention some things that happened you might want to check out. Yesterday, there was a big rally of janitors on Boston Common fighting big universities like Tufts, like Harvard, etc., because and other big corporations that subcontract from big contractors janitorial services, and they have all conspired together to cut healthcare and hours and just generally go after janitors' work and drive it down to nothing in the Boston area. This was started years ago, this trend. And at times, the janitors fight back and win through their union Service Employees International Union, SEIU. Primarily, most janitors are in that union. They fight back. They win some things. But it's always, you know, an up-and-down battle, especially since most corporations are using the shell game of subcontractors and outsourcing. So they'll say, you got this contract for this group of workers, but we're going to go with a different company now that doesn't have this contract. So the union works hard to organize the next company, the next company, the next company. It's like 20 big contractors that they've had to organize. I think I heard. I might have the figures wrong. And that is, of course, much harder than organizing workers that are directly employed by a corporation, linking them up with other workers that are also unionized. It's all, you know, the neoliberal attempts to atomize working people and destroy working class organizations, very much linked to two corporate political parties, Democrats and Republicans, that pursue these policies with abandon. They just love that stuff, actually, even though they don't talk about it much. And like, for example, the privatization of the T happening now here in the Boston area. They've already privatized the janitors years ago. Now they're going after warehouse workers, workers that count the money. I think they've been successful in privatizing some of these already. Workers that they're going after another group of workers now that I can't remember. This is after getting rid of all the toll collectors. A few may have stayed around for information. So they keep attacking the workforce at the T and making the service worse and worse. This is what they've done in other countries. They've done it around this country. The whole trick of privatization is to make the service so bad that people don't care so much if it gets privatized. And it's a huge mistake, of course, because once something is privatized, you lose any political control over it at all. And it just becomes charging whatever they want, closing down lines, whatever. And that is that's happened, for example, in British Rail. British Rail was privatized, so huge parts of the country lost regular service or lost service entirely, had their prices jacked up incredibly. And if you go to Europe now and you think you're going to have that nice European train ride experience, depends where you go and how successful the left and the working class has been in staving off privatization and outsourcing. It's happening right here in Boston, right under people's noses. Most people aren't aware of it. The T unions, part of the American Transportation Union, ATU, also known as the Carmen's Union locally in Boston, they are having a rally tomorrow, September 12th. Go to their website for more information, their Facebook page, Carmen's Union, and get more information on that. Also, I don't know if you might have seen this by some random chance, because I've only found it in the left, in the alternative media, but a fairly big factory of Lipton tea workers in Virginia have successfully organized the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. There's also open-ended strike of nurses in the Midwest, in Minneapolis, against, ironically, big hospitals trying to take away healthcare, trying to degrade and take away healthcare for nurses. That makes a lot of sense, right? You want your nurses to be sick when they're taking care of people. That's the logic of capitalism. And anyway, just a lot of labor stuff going on, relatively speaking. I'm not trying to say there's a mass movement or anything out there, but there are a lot of defensive struggles, and there are a lot of struggles of people in the Boston area, where you have these very rich institutions like the universities, and yet they act like vicious greedy corporations, of course, and try to take away, try to just victimize the workers over and over again. I'm part of that victimization. My healthcare costs are about to rise, and I can't afford it. My family can't afford it. And thank you very much, Harvard University, that just got a $7 billion increase in its endowment, on its way to about $9 billion in a two-year fundraising scheme that has netted them billions and billions and billions of dollars. And if, by the way, if you were here in the Boston area, if you live in the Boston area, every year when the students come back, a big deal is made about that, and rightly so. Boston has a lot of students, a lot of universities, and it impacts things in both good and bad ways. And that's certainly newsworthy, I would say. However, the downsides of gentrification in neighborhoods, of universities buying up housing in neighborhoods and so on, not paying any taxes, treating workers horribly, and just creating these outlandish fees and tuitions going up every year, there's a huge crisis brewing in higher education and education in general, that, you know, people aren't really that tuned into yet. I mean, I feel like I am, because I don't know how I'm going to pay for my kids going to college and so on, but a lot of people just aren't tuned into it. And it's not just higher education, it's just basic, education K through 12. I mean, there's just such stress. I mean, in Boston, this very rich city, they've been closing. There have been two waves of school closures in Boston over the last five or six years. Very significant school closures that people fought hard, but they fought them in a sort of neighborhood atomized basis. And the teachers union, although supporting a lot of the fights against the school closures, never was able or never tried or didn't know how to create a generalized fight back against that, which is very much tied to tea privatization from a certain working class socialist angle. And these struggles could have been joined together in solidarity and many other struggles that are happening. And so you have this idea in higher education in K through 12 education consistent now that there's no money. There's just no money around. Everything has to be cuts and everything has to be poorly funded. And meanwhile, the dirty little secret, and you can read this from numerous sources, Michelle Alexander, Jonathan Kozol, wherever. Structurally, this all stems from the federal government paying very, very, very little into education, the states paying less and less into education, and education being predominantly dependent on payroll, property taxes. And that, of course, creates this inherently unequal system where rich communities, and some of them super rich, have very well-funded schools and enormous resources, and other communities, most communities, having to pretend there's no money around out there here in the U.S., despite all the money you see, all the wealth that you see everywhere. Not everywhere, but all the wealth that you see. And there's supposedly no money for education. I just heard this thing. I heard a speech on the way into the show by Jeffrey Sachs, who is a capitalist criminal, basically masquerading as like he cares. He said a couple interesting things in his little speech. He said, number one, Democratic Party is funded by Wall Street. And that's almost a given for some people that are aware of reality, but other people just want to be in denial about that. So Democratic Party funded by Wall Street, by a big Wall Street theoretician, Jeffrey Sachs, ex-Harvard professor, so on. One of the shock doctrine people that went into Eastern Europe after the fall of Stalinism and created massive privatization and massive misery to reintroduce capitalism. And then later felt a little guilty about it and has, become sort of wants to have capitalism with a smiley face on it. Doesn't work. So anyways, there was that statement, Democratic Party controlled by, or funded by Wall Street, no kidding, Jeffrey Sachs. But then he also said he went into this whole, and this is why I would bother to listen to someone like this to begin with, maybe get some data. He said this whole thing about military spending and subsections of military spending, $90 billion here, billions here, blah, blah, blah. And he made a little joke about it, so much is spent per day on the military. It was like in the billions per day, $90 billion or some ridiculous figure that you can't even wrap your head around, spent on the military. Why doesn't everyone take the month of August off? All the armies around the world take August off, and you'll save enough money to provide, he doesn't mention this, by the way, but provide for 1 year, education and healthcare for people that lack it in the underdeveloped world. So he placed a $90 billion price tag on a year of increased, he didn't get into too much detail, but increased and decent, halfway decent education and healthcare for people that don't have access to it now or aren't getting it now in the world. I'd probably question those figures, but let's just go with it for a second. He said, so all you have to do, military, is cut back a little bit. All you have to do, military, is take the month of August off. What if they all took the month of August off? Ha ha, the liberals laugh, ha ha ha. Well, you know how many people, and unfortunately, this is true of good leftists as well, good socialists who they mistakenly or maybe inadvertently, you have to be careful how you do this, I've probably done it too, by pointing out the horrible excesses of the military budget and the horrible excesses of, say, corporate welfare and other things that go to not social services, but take up the vast majority of the budget of the United States government, and point those out to people and hopefully get them a little angry about that injustice. That can also lead to the idea that if you just cut a little bit of that, you solve the problems of capitalism. The problem is that you cut some of the, you know, it's sort of like another thing Sachs said is, oh, just put a 0.25% percent tax on hedge fund profits, you know, around the globe, which are in the trillions. And you'll get that $90 billion that you need. Again, whether it's the government taxation or whether it's cutting spending for the military, these are amounts of money that are freed up, you know, on a temporary basis, most likely. But let's leave that aside for a second. The amount of money you need to free up has to happen over and over again. So instead of begging to the people that control the wealth unjustly through coercion and violence and control over, you know, governments and their armies and so on and their police forces, why not create a world where that wealth is directly, the people that create the wealth also control the wealth, right? That's the fundamental kind of socialist argument against keeping things, you know, keeping begging the boss, which never seems to work. And by the way, why doesn't that work? Well, here's the argument even within capitalism that creates a conundrum that's never overcome, actually. You never do have these situations where even during the Depression in the United States, where there was increased social welfare spending, you never had a significant enough change in ownership of the means of production of big corporations and so on. You never had even significant nationalization straight out that would be a part of that, to change the dynamic of who controls, at the end of the day, the spigot, who controls, how much will be paid in taxes, how much will go out to social spending, how much will go to wages, et cetera. The capitalists remained, and Roosevelt did that job for them, controlling that. So they took a hit for a while, even into the 1950s, you had, as you might have read recently, some people have been digging this statistic out recently, you had 90% income tax rate on the richest people in the U.S., and you had a higher corporate tax rate. Now you're down to what the corporations cry about, a 34% tax rate, but none of them pay it. So it's false tiers, and it also needs to go up higher than that, higher than 34%. But right now, you have a corporate tax rate on paper of 34, it might be 32%. And yet the effective tax rate of what they actually pay, last time I checked, which was probably a couple of years ago, was around 18%. So let's say it's gone down since then, with the recent scandal of Apple not paying taxes and all that kind of in Ireland, all that kind of stuff. You can bet it's gone down. So you have effective tax rate in the teens, and the corporations are saying they're too much taxed, and you have the individual tax rates have flipped completely, nowhere near 90% now. Many rich individuals getting out of paying taxes. There's a reason Trump won't release his income tax. There's just been an incredible and purposeful flip in the tax burden from the rich and the big corporations back to the working class and not the big corporations or even the small corporations. And that's created this idea that, oh, there's no money around, but there is the money. There's tons of money around. And it can be going to education instead of property taxes, which, you know, earlier in the show, I was talking about personal survival strategies. And one of the things that undermines the sort of get off the grid movement, or even less people that just sort of hunker down in the suburbs trying to hold on to their homes and so on, is that, you know, with the decrease in wages and the stagnation in wages due to weakening unions, with the decrease, savage decrease in pensions, you got less, what is it, like 9%, 16%, I think it's 9% of the workforce having the traditional pension plans left, which were, you know, bosses, corporations pay into a pension fund as part of your compensation, rather than you paying into it, like in a 401k and all that stuff. Instead, with the decline and all that, you end up being, if you lose your job, say in your 40s or 50s or something, and you're thinking, well, I'm going to hold out of the house, stay in the neighborhood, or even younger age with a family, lose your job, you go through some hard times like a lot of people did in 2008, 2009, and still continuing for many. You try to hold on, but these property taxes, because that's the main funding for education now, and for a lot of other, for road construction and other things, boy, they keep going up. And they go up so high that you can't afford to live in your house anymore. And you try to sell your house, and if you're like a lot of people, you weren't able to keep up repairs, and the place is falling apart, and you end up selling your house for a lot less than you thought, and you're not done with your mortgage yet, you got to pay that off through the sale, and blah, blah, blah. You end up skidding downward in the social ladder very quickly, and it's just a lot of people going through a decline in living standards, or hanging on from paycheck to paycheck, which is an overall decline too in a lot of ways. A lot of choices, quote unquote, that are not being choices anymore, that can't be taken advantage of and used, that people remember from their childhood or they read about or something, in terms of what's available to your children, what's available to you in terms of travel, you know, all these things. So you have this general decline in living standards, general weakening in unions, which impacts the decline in living standards hugely. Got about 6% union density rate in the private sector now, 30% fluctuating up and down, but around 30%, oscillating around 30% in the public sector union, and under severe attack through privatization and outsourcing and so on. And it results in this kind of anger against politics as usual. And again, the corporate media talks about this more than you would think. But if you tune them out, I tend to listen to them, unfortunately, way too much to get some data and to rail and rant against them. But they will admit that the economy is so precarious for so many people, there, some of them will admit this, that there's a lot of anger out there, which manifested itself in, to a certain extent, the Sanders campaign, to a certain extent, however misplaced and crazy, into support for Trump. And Trump obviously taking advantage of it with this kind of right populist stuff against the trade agreements. And he doesn't mean any of it, really, but against the trade agreements and his vague promise of jobs. Clinton doing the same thing. If you talk, you know, talking about jobs and so on, but it all sounds very vague, even to, I think, very people that don't follow politics much. And that's because it is very vague. That's because it's not going to mollify at least a lot of people's anger, rightly so. Notice I'm not trying to use anger in a pejorative sense, although, you know, if it leads to voting for the corporate politicians, Trump or Hillary, it's a bad thing in my opinion, and opinion of socialists and others who are building for the future through supporting Stein and supporting locally left candidates and so on, independent left candidates. But the anger is justified in a lot of cases. The anger is righteous anger. The anger brings justice if it gets organized in a certain way. It also, though, does bring the danger of being taken advantage of by right populism and so on, or liberal populism, left populism in a sense. Before we get into this article I was promising to talk about, which is really worth reading, I want to make a couple book recommendations. There's a book called The Democrats, A Critical History by Lance Selfa. There's a version that came out around 2008, and it was updated with a bit in 2012. And, there's a lot, I'm sure I'm missing a lot of good analysis of problems with the Democratic Party and lesser evilism and that whole paradigm of the duopoly of the corporate politics ruling, another way to put it, dictatorship of big business over politics in this country through the Democratic and Republican parties. But this is just one book that I've read and found useful. I'm rereading it. It's got a lot of good information. And it gets into, for example, the myth of the New Deal, New Deal myth and reality in one section. And what I envision is the for not just for myself, but for social alternative and in general, to get out the information so clearly and so simply, and not in a bad way, simply, of the major icons of the Democratic Party, and just line that stuff up so people can really understand the reality of Roosevelt, the reality of Kennedy, the reality of Carter, the reality of Clinton, the reality of Truman, Johnson, some of these used as icons for the Democratic Party to claim that it is a party that is for working people. And in fact, there's a subheading in the book here, the party of slavery becomes the, quote, party of the people, unquote, and then knocks that down, obviously, the party of the people part. Really good stuff here on Roosevelt and the way he would bring in some sort of right-wing labor leaders and even some that claimed not to be right-wing into his cabinet to provide a sort of left cover for cuts, actually. There was not this like general increase in funding for New Deal programs. They would be created, put on a budget would be found to be too low. Didn't necessarily mean they increased the budget for these programs. It was based on a lot of people never were able to tap into these massive public works programs, but they would, if an election just happened, they'd actually cut the programs because they didn't need them till the next election 4 years later. Remember Roosevelt getting elected four times, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So anyway, for example, this is, a lot of people know about this, but many, many do not. Quote, the New Deal did not save the U.S. economy from the Great Depression, but the Second World War did. Between 1940 and 1945, the U.S. government spent more money than it had in the previous 150 years combined. A flood of government contracts lined the pockets of big business, while wartime wage and price controls, and unfortunately the CIO's no strike pledge, held down workers' incomes. But there were more, and I just paraphrase, that's the end of the quote, there were more jobs and so on, but it took until the 42, 43, 44 for that to kick in. And then still, as we said earlier in the show, when workers got back from World War II, from serving in the army and the armed forces, there was a general strike in 1946 in Oakland. There was huge strikes in 1946. There was a big strike in 1949, nationwide strike, because basically a lot of vets came back to poor housing. Jobs they had been promised were taken away from them. Wages stagnating, conditions not what you would expect from a country that supposedly you just fought and died for, or others died for, you fought for, and et cetera, et cetera. And of course, you had in 1947 the Taft-Hartley Act, which some labor bureaucrats would say was a good thing, right-wing labor bureaucrats, was actually part of, in a way, the McCarthyist mood that was growing at the time, that was mostly an attack on the labor movement. And by the way, Truman said he was against it and then never did anything to stop it and never tried to repeal it. But that was enough for the CIO to support Truman at the time. CIO was much more radical in some ways at the time, obviously. It had just been created in the early 30s. Anyway, really good stuff in this book, The Democrats, A Critical History by Lance Selfa. Also one that I just wrote a book review on, that it's in the latest edition of Socialist Alternatives, newspaper Social Alternative. It's called Listen Liberal or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People by Thomas Frank. Now, Selfa, the other book, The Democrats' Critical History, Selfa is a socialist and much more thorough and logical and scientific than Frank, who is a corporate bourgeois, corporate media journalist, basically. But Frank is also sort of has done this thing like sort of like Kevin Phillips. Thomas Frank was a Republican, you know, in college or whatever. Saw the what was going on, felt it, moved into liberalism, wrote a book called What's the Matter with Kansas? Trying to figure out why did Kansas, a state that had like a left and also a liberal voting record, and actual left voting record, like socialist I'm talking about, and then also a liberal voting record in the past, end up electing Republicans. I forget which election he was focused on. I think it was 2004 with whatever happened to Kansas. What's the matter with Kansas? Sorry. Anyway, his latest book is Listen Liberal. Interesting book because it came out fairly recently, like in like April of this year. And he was already predicting Clinton. He was a Sanders fan, but he devotes all of two sentences to Sanders in the book because he just said, Clinton's going to get it based on the way the Democratic Party is structured and it's her turn, quote unquote, but from the powers, as far as the powers that be are concerned, the elites that run the Democratic Party, the corporate elites. And he was right about that, of course, that he wasn't the only one predicting that, obviously. But he was right about it. So he doesn't spend much time in here, hardly any, talking about of Sanders. He's talking about instead everyone from Hillary to the Democrats, Democratic Party history during the Clinton administration, Obama, so on. So it's like a recent outline of some parts of the Democratic Party. Now, it doesn't go far enough, and he gets very much derailed, in my opinion, by this whole. He starts to get very irritated with what he calls the innovation economy and the Democrats sucking up to Silicon Valley and all that, you know. That's just part of the capitalist class, and it doesn't really need. He thinks he's like breaking semi new ground here with this. When you know, you can go back to sociologists like Veblen and so on, and read stuff that was getting into the technocratic class and all that. I mean, it's nothing new. So he just basically sort of makes a lot of subheadings of the portions of the capitalist class and goes after them in a way that's really not necessary. I think there's more of a mix than that. But having said that, there are some good, really good parts of the book. For example, a chapter called The Blue State Model, where he looks at Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and others, and shows in this time of burgeoning inequality and cuts in education and so on, you've got these like very rich people in power, very well educated people in power, and they are doing the same things in states totally controlled by the Democratic Party. There's not one bit of pressure from the Republicans of any sort in a state like Massachusetts or Rhode Island or New York that is worth anything, even when they have the governorship. Right now you've got Baker as the governor of Massachusetts. He's a Republican. He acts like a run-of-the-mill Democrat. And when he does his privatization attacks on education and on the T and so on, the Democrats play along with it. You know, like I'll give you an example besides the T, what's happening with the T. There's a big question on the ballot in Massachusetts called Question 2 in this coming up election. And it's called, there's a campaign called Save Our Schools, which I'm supporting and Socialist Alternative is supporting. Called that's calling out this new referendum that is trying to hold on a second, sorry. That's trying to increase the number of charter schools that can be done in Massachusetts. In other words, take the cap off charter schools, and that means basically more privatization of education, more money going into private companies masquerading as educational enterprises. Charter schools can take students they choose, do what they want, no public oversight, no public pressure, no PTO, et cetera, et cetera. And big money behind the charter school movement. Oh, yes, Koch brothers money, Bill Gates money. It's huge. Check the charter school movement out. Now, where it gets complicated is that they have bought off a section of the upper middle class populations in inner cities in some places, They've bought off, they're just in a token way, they've bought off, of course, elements of the Democratic Party. In fact, the Democratic Party in general is not against charter schools. There's no, you can't find a Democratic Party plan that says no charter schools. So you have like de Blasio in New York supporting that, Clinton supporting charter schools in a general sense, and here in Massachusetts, Democrats going along with Baker. Meanwhile, the Massachusetts Teachers Association, a union I have friends in, and that's a good union in a lot of ways, they are pushing back, and they are calling for a vote no on question two. I'll be voting no on question two. You should vote no on question two. Stop the march towards privatization of education, because you're going to wake up one day where you thought you could just send your kid to school with the irritating fees from public education that exist now and maybe handle that, but wait till you have to handle a tuition. But you have to handle a tuition the size of a college tuition, what college used to be, what a college tuition used to be. That's the reality they're working for. Wait till you're in a city, and maybe you already are, where the charter schools exist, and you're in some sort of weird competition you can't quite figure out to try to get your kid into one because you think it's going to be better. Then you get your kid into one, and it absolutely sucks. Wait till your kid graduates from college. This happened to a friend of mine. And goes to Teach for America. The first thing they hear Teach for America is, don't you have anything to do with the teachers union? Don't you talk to the teachers union? If you have anything to do with unions, we're going to kick you out of here right away. Explicitly anti-union propaganda. There's a class war. Very, very explicit in a lot of places where the rich rule, right? Teach for America, bullshit. It's just a privatization scheme. There's places in America where the class struggle is very, very, very obvious. And charter schools as a whole, a place like Massachusetts, a lot of liberals doing well, relatively speaking, they don't see the danger or they support it. And it's just another club to hit working people over the head with. So we obviously are against charter schools. We're against raising the cap on charter schools. A lot of ways to make public education 10 times better than any charter school could dream of. But something like progressive taxation is just like off the cards, even in a state. This is what the Thomas Frank book's getting into in this chapter on states and cities totally controlled by the Democrats. They don't even get into the idea of progressive taxation. Whenever taxation comes up, it's like, oh, you have to tax everybody. And that means inevitably taxes on working people are going to go up tremendously. And working people are sensitive to that propaganda because our taxes do go up all the time. Our fees do go up all the time. They're doing this thing on the mass turnpike, I-90, of eliminating toll booths. Well, maybe that'll make the horrific traffic jams that those of us that have to commute experience every day. But on the other hand, they're going to raise toll fares, you know? There's no reason for that. And you get hit by these fees and these taxes and these tolls all the time. So when the corporate politicians of the Democratic and Republican parties start talking about how they don't want to raise taxes, they're against taxation, or therefore, like in Clinton's case, certain taxation. You'll notice when you dig into it that it is taxes that's going to hit workers for the most part, not always, but for the most part. Or it's a very mild tax increase on the rich and big corporations, because the whole idea of progressive taxation is so such an anathema now, so off the table, but you can't even talk about it. Whereas before, it was like, you know, that 90% figure on, 90, I think it got up to 92% or something like that, on the super rich in the U.S., that was a definite last-ditch move to save capitalism. Not something that they wouldn't talk about. It was something they talked about gladly, they being big business corporate politicians, because they knew that the crumbs from taxation, from increased taxation, would be nothing compared to what a socialist revolution would bring about, which would be public ownership of the, you know, ways that they make their money. So, but now it's dropped. Things have dropped so back, and a lot of it's due to the duopoly, the political duopoly, of the corporate political parties, the Democrats, Republicans, that even progressive taxation is just off the cards. Listen, Liberal by Thomas Frank. Check it out. Now, don't wait. Democrats Critical History by Lance Selfa. Check that out even more now. Don't wait. what is it? There's 60 some days to the election. Really good article. Also, not in terms of just analyzing the Democratic Party, but in terms of what to do about things. September 7th, 2016, Counterpunch, and I think it might have got out to some other websites, counterpunch.org. Author Jonathan Martin, professor of sociology at Framingham State. I got to look this guy up. Got to look up his book, Empowering Progressive Third Parties. Want to talk to this guy. Hopefully he's a socialist. He says, quote, "Beyond Bernie, the hidden potential of progressive third parties." So check this out on counterpunch.org and perhaps elsewhere. Beyond Bernie, the hidden potential of progressive third parties. And in this article, yay, he mentioned socialist alternative a couple times. First he starts off just talking about Sanders. I think he gives Sanders a little too much due, or whatever the word is. But he does qualify it a bit more than some people. But what he's really looking at is, quote, "Much evidence documented in my new book and elsewhere counters the pervasive dogma that progressive third parties can't win and, quote, can't make a difference." So he starts off with the Republican Party. Hey, yeah, that was a third party. He goes, "Remarkably, the Republican Party itself offers the first most striking example of what can be accomplished. Mid-19th century actually began as a third party. Central goal that was progressive for its time, which was, against slavery. It exposed the expansion of slavery, at least, and it quickly replaced one of the two major pro-slavery parties, including the Democrats, but didn't replace the Democrats, and elected President Lincoln, obviously, who eventually signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But even more to the point, getting closer to our time, 19th populists in the late 19th century, socialists in the early 20th century. I've got a good quote here from Eugene Debs. If you never heard of him, please look him up. Debs was one of the greatest socialist leaders in American history, leader of the Socialist Party. Actually ran for president from a prison cell because they threw him in prison for speaking against World War I. That was a crime. A Democrat threw him in prison, Woodrow Wilson, threw him in prison because it was a crime to speak against World War, going off to war, to the meat grinder of World War I. And he gave a speech where he, you know, was trying to actually obey the law, believe it or not. But he just couldn't help himself and said, you know, certain things that could be construed as against the war. He was trying to talk against the draft and stuff. And they took it as, that's good enough, Eugene. Off to federal prison for you for X number of, I think it was a huge number of years, but got, he was so popular that his sentence was cut somewhat. But he did do some hard time in federal prison. By the way, quite popular with the inmates at the time because he was a socialist. Deb said, let's see, I think this is around 1900, greatest socialist leader in the American working class, produced Dr. Kojar, yeah, 1900, quote, "We hear it frequently urged that the Democratic Party is, quote, the poor man's party or a friend of labor, quote unquote. There is but one way to relieve poverty and to free labor, that is by making common property of the tools of labor. It is the Democratic Party, which we are assured has strong socialist tendencies, in favor of collective ownership of the means of production? Is it opposed to the wage system from which flows a ceaseless stream of poverty, misery, and wretchedness of the children of toil?" Again, you know, little language from the 20th century, early 20th century, but there you go. "If the Democratic Party is the friend of labor, quote unquote, any more than the Republican Party, why is this platform silent in the presence of the Coeur d'Alene massacre?" This was where the Idaho state government declared martial law in 1899 against a miner strike. "It knows the truth about these shocking outrages, crimes upon working men, their wives and children, which would blacken the pages of Siberia. Why not speak out against it? What has the Democratic Party to say about the property and educational qualifications in North Carolina, Louisiana, in the proposed general disenfranchisement of the Negro race in the southern states?" Meaning the Jim Crow legislation against voting in the southern states. Then to finish off the quote, "The differences between the Republican and Democratic parties involve no issue, no principle in which the working class has any interest, or whether the spoils be distributed by Republicans," and then he mentions a few couple names, Hanna and Platt, "or by the Democrats, Croker and Tammany Hall, it's all the same to the working class. Between these parties, socialists have no choice, no preference." Now, if you listen closely to that quote, Debs isn't saying the Republicans and the Democrats are exactly the same, and we're not saying that either. But on fundamental issues, especially of the economy, especially of imperialism, they are very, very, very similar. And on social issues, one moment's lesser evilism can be next moment's greater evil. You know, there's this, if you look carefully, it's mass, and U.S. history is mass movements that create the most progressive social legislation, not the election of Democrats. I mean, people voted Obama in thinking he was going to do all this stuff, progressive legislation, everything from the Employee Free Choice Act to single-payer health care to whatever. We end up with no Employee Free Choice Act. We end up with more people deported than in any other administration. We end up with a health care bill or health care system that is basically a big one big corporate welfare gift to the big corporations involved in private insurance, hospitals, and pharmaceuticals. And the best you can say about it is it's gotten a few more people health insurance, but for how long? Because the latest is on Obamacare is basically that the big insurance companies are pulling out of the so-called exchanges in many different regions, leaving people with fewer choices or no choices and higher premiums, higher even those that get some subsidies from the government for those premiums. So it's a real mess, and its survivability, regardless of feeble attacks by the Republicans on it, the survivability of it is very much in doubt. But back to this article by Jonathan Martin, he goes on to talk about other examples I don't have time to get into, but then, interestingly enough, he mentions Shama Sawant. He talks about local levels of successful progressive quote unquote third parties. Shama Sawant is a popular city councilor in a larger city in her own state. It's Washington State. She could become a viable candidate for mayor or state legislator. Potential springboards to running competitive races for governor or members of Congress. The metropolitan area may also enable her to work her way up to statewide or federal office. Other successful left third-party officials at the local level could make a similar descent. He mentions Richmond, California, for example. And actually, the early career of Sanders shows that as well. He says Seattle, another place that had been dominated by Democrats, their socialist alternative, Shama Sawant, won a 2013 city council race that against a longtime Democratic incumbent. And Shama got reelected in 2015. I actually went out to Seattle to help with that election. It was great. Once in office, Sawant quickly made an impact with big ripple effects. Among some progressive reforms she helped orchestrate was the nation's first $15 minimum wage, passed in June 2014. It required mobilizing much public support to overcome substantial resistance by the local political establishment. Since then, this breakthrough has inspired similar struggles and victories elsewhere in the nation. In turn, that has heightened pressure for an increase in the national minimum wage. The surprising success of Sawant and other candidates, meaning progressive left candidates, profiled above, suggests there could be additional left third-party openings yet to be fully exploited. He's absolutely right, I think, in this. He goes, at the same time, Shama Sawant has been actually calling for a new national umbrella party for the 98%, which she and Socialist Alternative plan to launch sometime after the election. Now, that actually is not completely true. We are working on getting the forces together, hopefully, to move towards building that sort of thing. So, running out of time, but check out that article by Jonathan Martin in Counterpunch, Beyond Birdie, The Hidden Potential of Progressive Third Parties. Also, Build a Party to 99%. Support Jill Stein, an article from socialistalternative.org, which I don't have time to get into right now. One thing I want to talk about, again, I have to say for the future, but it was related to the 911 discussion. I have an article from Common Dreams from The Intercept by Glenn Greenwald, quote, "Why did the Saudi regime and other Gulf tyrannies donate millions to the Clinton Foundation?" And that just came out August 25th. And, quote, "As the numerous and obvious ethical conflicts surrounding the Clinton Foundation receive more media scrutiny, the tactic of Clinton loyal journalists is to highlight the charitable work done by the foundation, then insinuate or even outright state that anyone raising these questions is opposed to its charity. James Carville announced that those who criticize the foundation are going to hell." But the Clinton Foundation, et cetera, you know, you've probably read other articles about where, you know, question about where its money comes from. For example, a group called Friends of Saudi Arabia gave $5 million, State of Qatar, et cetera. Enough time to get into the article, but anyway, check that out. Glenn Greenwald's been doing some good writing on, he hasn't like fallen into the, like basically the propaganda camp of journalists for Clinton. I want to get into more about Obamacare And here's just a direct quote. Obamacare is in big trouble. Quote, Obamacare death spiral. And this is from popularresistance.org, but they were riffing off of other articles that appeared actually in the corporate media. And this is even before that EpiPen scandal came out. I don't know if you heard about that, but people that are dependent on EpiPen, EpiPen-induced drugs, shots for allergies, that just shot up incredibly in cost. And then other people came forward with other things that have shot up from the pharmaceutical industry in costs lately, as the pharmaceutical industry, like the hospital industry, like the insurance industry, all are consolidating more and more after a period of slight deregulation so they could make more profits. The inevitable quick monopolization has happened, and it is happening in insurance, in hospitals, and in pharmaceuticals. And they're using that, and they've used it already in many ways. It's nothing new, and I'm not saying that to excuse it, but it's just getting more intense to raise prices tremendously. I think they really see not only just the general short-term maximization profit thing, but they see that the writing is on the wall. One of these days, we are going to get health care in this country for everyone, or there's going to be a revolution, or there's going to be a collapse of the system in terms of, like, you know, the basic contradictions in the system. And you could just see these healthcare people, like Baker, he was one of them, trying to get all the money they can before they realize they just can't anymore. That's just going to be too outrageous. What they're doing is going to, in the future, what they're doing is going to be considered a crime punishable by long terms of imprisonment, much less business as usual like it is now. So I'm going to stop there. I had a bunch of stuff on the healthcare issue, but we're out of time. Thanks for listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., with talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. We hope you got something out of the show. Again, we're trying not just for that alternative information, but for you to commit. We're trying to get you to get involved with the socialist movement, and that does exist out there, even though it's under the radar in a lot of places. We're going to leave you with some music by New Model Army, and if we have time, some music by John Lennon, which we end a lot of shows with, his song Imagine. But really, thanks for listening, and try to get out to that rally of the tea workers, if you're from this area, of Boston area, tomorrow. And then also on Monday, September 19th, 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Clark University in Worcester, if you're from the Worcester area or you want to take the trip out there, Grace Conference Room. Theo Winston, National Chair of Socialist Students in Britain. He's a student at Nottingham University doing a national tour for Socialist Alternative on the question of a world in turmoil and the Socialist Alternative, and organizing students into the Socialist movement. So again, take care and get involved in changing the world better now than never. And thanks for listening.
Well, they hardly know their secret mother tongue. Yeah, but they recognize the duty to defend the flag hanging limp